Hello, everybody. Welcome to Media Voices. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
So this week I spoke to Ranj Begley, the managing director of Readly. It's a subscription-based magazine platform that lets users read as many titles as they want for a single monthly fee. That sounds similar to something else that got announced this week. So we spoke about Apple News Plus, the economics of news and entertainment content on the same platform, and why covers are still so important for digital magazines.
But before we get into the news roundup, don't forget to bookmark Thursday, May the 2nd for our 100th episode celebration. This one here is number 98. So we're going to be doing a live recording in London, and we're going to look at the topic, how do publishers maintain their brand value in a world of distributed content? So we'll have some brilliant guests on board, which we'll release details of soon. But a big thanks to our event partners Biblio, who are helping us to kind of organise all this. Look out for registration details in the newsletter.
So regular listeners might remember that last week we trailed this big Apple event at which they were going to announce a new subscription service. Esther, what actually happened there? What did they announce?
Oh my word. Okay. So they kind of announced what we got the idea that they would announce last week, which is not what we thought they'd announced the week before. So they've announced Apple News Plus, among other things, which means you get unlimited access to all magazines for, funnily enough, $9.99. And it launched in the US and Canada first. It's coming to the UK soon. But we thought that they would announce a subscription service focusing on magazines. But what they're actually doing, which really gets my goat, is they're doing like a premium subscription service built into their news app, Apple News Plus, which means that they're going to be mixing magazine PDFs and kind of responsive content from our Apple News' RSS feeds into like one weird subscription mash. When you come to read news and when you come to read magazines, you come with completely different intent. And I don't think something where you've got them mixed in on one platform of, oh, this is content, here's a way to read it, is going to work. It's like you've taken a tech hammer and smashed it over journalism's head.
Right. So you're saying that people don't choose to read news content in the same way that they choose to read magazine issues, which is effectively what this is, yeah. Right? It's very much the texture model.
Yeah, exactly.
No. It's not the texture model.
It's texture.
look at the number. I mean, this was... Did you actually watch this?
No, I didn't. I was following
like
it on Twitter.
Watching a frigging cult.
Apple.
Yeah, maybe that's every Apple presentation. But every time one of these numpties says something, it's like, woo, 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 woo. So one of them stands up and he says, oh, we're going to have 3,000 magazines on Apple News Plus. No. We're going to have 300 magazines on Apple News Plus. And Texture already had 205.
Okay, so they found 95 more. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, there's a fun side note in this. Apparently, Hearst, Meredith and Condé Nast have all got their publications on the app. Apparently, that's because they're contractually obliged to, because they were former owners of the app.
Ah, smart.
So I don't know. The whole thing just seems a little bit... It's like they're making this huge deal about something that really is not a particularly huge deal.
And not many publications have actually gone for this. Which news publications are actually on board?
The Wall Street Journal is the only newspaper.
Only newspaper, yeah, but not the only news publisher.
Well, what are we including? Vox and The Skim and...
Yeah, exactly. The Cut, TechCrunch. They're all on board, and perhaps their content fits slightly better than the newspapers. Well, but Wall Street Journal is creating...
Okay, so here's my fury. That brings you right back to what Esther's talking about. How can you mash these things together?
This is just one of the things that Apple has... this is the company that completely revolutionised the way that we use hardware and smartphones and things like that. And this is just so disappointing that all of the things that they announced at this event are just carbon copies of things that already exist. Except this, which is just some weird alien baby hybrid mashup that should just go back in the bin.
You've been watching too much Alien 3.
It was also the propaganda around it. Like, what's his name? Cook? Tim Cook? Standing up saying...
Tim Apple.
Tim Apple.
You get $8,000 worth of stuff for the low, low price of $9.99. But no one ever subscribed to $8,000 worth of stuff. That's not the way it works. The only saving grace for me was Wyatt Mitchell. Wyatt's the guy that came on in the cream boiler suit.
Yeah.
And I met him at Magfest. He's a lovely, lovely man, a really nice guy, and a real, you know, a serious magazine legend in terms of design and what he did at the New Yorker. But just the fact that he come on in this outfit, where it was the most un-Steve Jobs outfit you could ever imagine, that was the only saving grace for this whole thing.
Okay, so as I understand it, I guess their proposition to news publishers is that they do not necessarily have to put every single story on there. That this could effectively be a marketing tool for them. And in fact, in the case of the Wall Street Journal, they're commissioning, or rather they're paying for the Wall Street Journal to create content specifically for Apple News Plus.
But why? What are you going to be creating that you couldn't put on a website?
Well, it's not necessarily that you couldn't put that on a website. It's that that then makes this another incidental source of revenue, quite apart. They're basically betting that this won't cannibalize their existing subscriptions.
They can't do that for everyone. That's where it does come back to the economics of this.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I'm really interested with the economics, so I presume if somebody reads an article from the Wall Street Journal will get, you know, cents for that. If you read a magazine, are you getting cents for like that entire body of content? Well, this is where it doesn't match up.
Yeah, we don't know enough about that. And in fact, it's a lot of the kind of the proposition to the consumer is that advertisers will be unable to track exactly what you're looking at, which got a kind of rousing response from the people in the audience. You know, the idea that advertisers can no longer track you, which I think is more advertising problem.
To be fair, when a guy reached up to scratch his left ear, that got a rousing response from the audience. Okay, Chris, you said you were going to mount a robust defense of Apple News Plus. I'm still waiting.
All right, absolutely. Let's do this.
Should we just move on to the correspondent?
Hang on. You've got... It's good for... Consumers might like it. I haven't...
I think you can share the subscription with your kids.
I think from a publisher perspective, and specifically a newspaper perspective, this might be a way to just earn incidental revenue and keep the stuff that people are going to pay for, like the Wall Street Journal's kind of business reporting and financial analysis, separate. So they're basically betting that the high quality stuff that people will pay for will still exist elsewhere, and this is just additive revenue.
Yeah, lame.
Well, as discussed, it doesn't seem like many news publishers are on board with it. And Esther, you've said that only a few of them are only on there as a bit of a technicality. So
yes.
It's pretty much exactly what we thought it was going to be. Even with me playing the best devil's avocado I can't really summon much of a defense. Moving on then, another long-running story which seems to have hit a bit of an iceberg this week. The Correspondent, which is the kind of the English language version of The Correspondent. So it raised $2.5 million for what was widely believed to be a move to the US. And this week, or rather last week, it announced that it is not actually going to be doing that. So Peter, what is the kind of technical difference that they're making here?
Oh, this story really depressed me on a variety of different levels. You know, anyone that's listened to the podcast knows that I am a massive The Correspondent fanboy.
Oh, you haven't mentioned it.
And they fucked up, you know. They've not to put too fine a point on it.
It's a PR boobo that is.
Well, it is to us, but if you look at some of the response to this in the US, people are going apeshit.
Yeah, people are really pissed off about
this. They're talking about scams, they're talking about cons. It's just awful. But Ernst Jan Fouth wrote a post on Medium, as they do. They do all their company updates on Medium. And he basically said, you know, as part of a regular update on what's going on, they will not be having an office in the States. They're closing their campaign office. They set up an office in the States to raise money, basically, to launch the idea of being an English language version of The Correspondent. But people took from that, and I include me in this, that they were going to have a US base. Now, whether that was in Manhattan or whether it was somewhere that didn't cost as much, I don't know. But the idea was really kind of almost that default notion, that assumption that they were going to be based in New York or in the States somewhere. So when Ernst Young has come out and said, well, actually, we're going to base our headquarters for this in Amsterdam with the correspondence headquarters, or in the correspondence headquarters, people in the States particularly have just gone apeshit and said, "Whoa, we thought you were going to fix US publishing and you're
But they are hiring reporters in the US.
Not many.
Well,
no, but okay.
You know, let's start.
But here's
start somewhere.
Here's where perception and reality parts company.
Yeah.
It was backed by people from 130 different countries. The people who are reacting against, they're not like MAGA nutcases. It's not, this isn't about, oh, make America great, have a newsroom. It's not like that. It's people that really feel that, oh, we kind of thought you were going to be here and we feel like we've been missold.
Yeah, that seems to be it. To what extent then do you think this is just US centrism on part of the commentators?
I think that's part of it. I also think once you think it through, like Esther and I have a very similar reaction to this. We don't give a shit.
Mm.
We don't care if they've got a US newsroom. We care that they produce really, really good English language content that's better than what's available at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, in the initial mail out that they said to kind of explain what happened here, I'm just going to read directly from that. They said, "Our US founding members were crucial to reaching our crowdfunding goal. Around 40% of those who backed the correspondent were in the United States, and without them, we would not be on track to launch your unbreaking news platform on September 30th, 2019.
The thing I think is quite sad about this is the people that have been saying, oh, I want a refund.
Yeah.
Like, is that really enough? Is the location really that important to you that is a deal breaker?
I suppose because so much of their message was about, you know, unbreaking the news, which, can people stop using that pun, please? They've used it. Russ Bridge has used it. It's winding me up now. But I think the idea was that people, this 40% who funded it, said, well, they're going to have an impact on the US news landscape here.
And that's what I mean by it's not the MAGA hat-wearing nutcases that are having a problem with this. It's people who actually care about countering that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember Rafat was getting quite angry about it on Twitter.
Rafat got so angry about it.
I think it's
a sensible decision that's just been communicated quite
exactly,
badly.
Exactly. And I hope they can move past it. I think the disappointment that we all feel in this is that when we watched an organisation who were so open through the Membership Puzzle Project about here's a business model that's working, here's a way we can do this, they were so open and transparent and they talked about transparency all the time, then to come and say, oh, by the way, we won't be in New York. That's a disappointing thing about it. I hope they get past it, though. I really do.
Yeah, I don't think this is...
I don't want a refund, guys.
You just want one of those four or five reporter positions based in the US.
I don't. I just want someone to fix the shit show that is our news ecosystem.
Well, moving on then. Google is partnering with McClatchy to fund new local media sites. And this is, I know, how many times do you hear that Google, you know, putting money into fixed journalism, the bastards.
Yeah, I'm getting like really bad data, like, because Facebook and Google have almost got like a massive cockwaving competition to try and fund as much local news as they can. What number of fund is this now?
Oh, fuck knows. And they all have two similar names. I've said that this is now called the Local Experiments Project.
Oh, for goodness.
Which was, what was the BBC one from last week?
Local Democracy Fund or something.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, can we just take Local Experiments Project out of context? That sounds really sinister.
So, yeah, Google is funding dozens of new local news websites in the US and eventually moving on into kind of international territories. And the sites are going to be built by selected partners with local news expertise. So Google are going to have no editorial say. So this first partnership with McClatchy, which has, you know, 162-year expertise in local news, 30 newsrooms across America. See, it's a difficult one for me because at the same time, Peter, you always have very, you know, mixed feelings about this, because the fact that local journalism needs saving is in itself sad. But at this point, do we not need to grab the life rafts, you know, from whichever way they come?
Yeah, I think so. You're right. I find this conversation in and of itself depressing. Mm. But if we've got to rely on Google, then we've got to rely on Google. And I think the fact that they're doing this is better than not doing it. No pressure on McClatchy, but they've got to make this work. You know, there's a lot of pressure there to do something important.
So we're reading this on Axios, and I think there's some quite interesting things in there that are worth pulling out. So the goal isn't to go into kind of huge, big metropolitan areas. It's going into smaller cities. And McClatchy CEO Craig Foreman says that that is because that's where local news decay is the worst. And if you've read the kind of terrifying examples of what happens with news deserts and when local towns lose their newspapers, you can understand why they're going to do this. But at the same time, it's also because that's where engagement happens on a really local level, and that's what they're trying to foster again. So I think there's some very, very interesting things to take away from this.
But it's like all the other funds that come up for this, how are they going to fix this permanently and sustainably? You know, the money's all very well until we basically all lose interest in the problem and the money runs out again.
They don't necessarily need to fix it forever. They just need to tide them over until people have found a way to make journalism sustainable in a kind of digital first era.
Yeah, that's the. It's not a bit. Well, I take exception to the phrase tiding them over. but I think you're right. They need to find a sustainable model. So that's what I mean about pressure on McClatchy. If McClatchy can go out, or whoever, it doesn't matter who it is, under any of these initiatives, if they can create a model that works locally that other people can piggyback or pick up, then brilliant. And the news in brief. Bustle Digital Group has bought Josh Topolsky's The Outline. It previously bought Gawker and Mike. I guess we were a bit worried, I suppose, that The Outline had just gone, yeah? Mm. It got a bit weird, not paying people and stuff. Or something.
Never a good sign.
I can't remember.
And my favourite story of the week, the European Parliament has voted to pass the really controversial copyright directive, which is the Article 11 and 13 you've been hearing about. But everyone's blaming some Swedish MEPs for making a mistake in that they pressed the wrong button. So goodness knows what's actually going to happen, because it apparently only very narrowly passed the directive.
Unilever, who are one of the world's biggest advertisers, it's setting up a list of trusted publishers for its digital advertising. But we don't know who's on the list yet, so we'll keep our eye on that.
Twitter is considering labelling Trump tweets that violate its rules against bullying, dehumanisation and threatening harm. Jesus Christ, that's going to be quite a label.
And Medium have come back around with yet more promises to publishers. And there's a fantastic piece on Newman Lab about this. They're seeking partners to create new publications on Medium, which we will help fund and distribute. Sound familiar?
Are we in 2015?
This is piece by Laura Hazard-Owen.
Yeah,
it's
brilliant.
We'll pop a link in the newsletter.
It's fantastic. And I feel like, you know what? This has just been the deja vu episode, because Millennium Media Companies, Group 9 and Refinery 29 are allegedly in talks to merge. It was only maybe a couple of weeks ago that BuzzFeed were in talks to merge with Group 9. And finally, The Pool has taken its entire archive offline, highlighting the need for publishers to consider archiving their stock of back articles, if only for their journalists' sake.
And you may have noticed we've got a growing transcript section on our website. There's a little link in our sidebar. And that's thanks to Trint's clever AI transcription tool. So you can go to voices.media/transcripts to see them all. And there's also a link to our dedicated email list that sends them out every Monday.
So this week I spoke to Ranj Begley, who is Managing Director of Readly. We spoke about how magazine platforms have come of age effectively, how publishers are using Readly data to experiment, and whether there's a wet dog for digital publications. First off, though, I asked her what Readly's pitch to publishers is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, changed it really has. I mean, we've gone from being an unknown Swedish startup to a scale-up. You know, and from back in the day when the business was first launched, I was knocking on publishers' doors. And now we've gone to being sort of named the third fastest growing technology company in Sweden and then listed in the top, you know, 200 FT's fastest growing companies. So I guess in answer to your question there, it definitely has changed. And I also think the reasons why publishers are joining Readly have changed as well, I guess, because, you know, the second part of your question there is, and to answer that, we've got three key reasons. The first one being strategic audience development. You know, at the end of the day, we are growing the brand's footprint. We're growing our own brand footprint as well, and we're bringing new eyeballs and new audiences to the publishers' brands. So our route to market is very different from the publishers, and they can really jump on the bandwagon and take advantage of that. The second reason would be for tactical subscription delivery. It's all about volume. You know, and bearing in mind that we've been really focusing on expansion and marketing over the last couple of years, we are pushing out, say, for instance, the UK magazines to the German market and vice versa. So you know, for that expat community and for where people want to read content and content on the go, we make that available for them. Mm. And then I think the final reason, or the this is what I say the main reason is, I'm sure my Swedish colleagues might object, it's all reference to data. And it's all the audience insights. So we can deliver on how our readers engage on from both an editorial and advertising perspective as well. So this is based around real data usage. So we can see where people are actually coming in to read a magazine, where they're dropping off, how long they're spending on ads, what articles they're reading, you know, basically what piques their interest. Mm. We have heat maps to prove that as well. And we share all of that data with our publishers.
See, that data sharing seems like that's a huge selling point, particularly now when everyone's kind of transitioning into, well, completely changing their business models. Knowing everything about that is kind of absolutely vital.
I know. I mean, Chris, it's so exciting because it's so cool and exciting. And I promise you, I'm not a nerd in any which way or form. But, you know, when you actually look at a heat map and you can see that, you know, Weight Watchers readers, for instance, stop reading on a Thursday afternoon because the diet goes out the window and then they start again on a Monday, you can literally see the behavioural patterns through the heat map. We can see, for instance, you know, that 33% of men read Cosmopolitan. Mm. You know, we know that women are going in and reading Gay Times. So there's a real mishmash of people, and it really does stimulate consumption. So the data part for me is the really exciting part, and our publishers love that. They really do love it.
And how has the, as that kind of pitch to publishers has changed over the years, how has the pitch to audiences changed, or has that stayed mostly the same?
There's a number of enhancements that we have released and will be released in the next coming months. I mean, obviously that's going to improve the user experience and obviously differentiate us from the competition. Mm. I mean, you've probably heard, there's so much press about it, the daily newspapers that we've launched in Germany as well. So from that perspective, that's something new that we're putting out there. Mm. Things like the recommendation engine, favoriting titles, bookmarking articles, there's a whole host of stuff, little things to a consumer that are important, very, very important. You know, customers would like the idea, they like the idea of, say, saving all their recipes to a folder so they can go back in and pull on that data when they want to. I like the idea when I'm looking for handbags or dining tables or whatever that I've got everything in one folder. So there's a whole host of stuff that is in development and then also will be released shortly.
Do you find then that audiences are becoming more habituated to the idea of these kind of digital plus titles? They no longer think of magazine content as being something that is tied to a physical page.
Yeah, I think the lines between, you know, a magazine and article reading and reading digitally are becoming relatively blurred. I mean, as you know, on Readly, it is the magazine that you're going into read, and it's long form, short form, whichever way you want to look at it, trusted, curated content. So I think, you know, there's a mixture of customers really in terms of what we have. So I guess people like to snack and they trust the content that they've got there. And obviously when they have more free time, they want to go and read more long form trusted content as well. So yeah.
I see. I'm fascinated by the idea that now you have all this user data, you can see kind of how people are, whether that's dipping into new magazines or whether they're staying with their perennial favorites. So, you know, do you try to, you mentioned this recommendation engine. Are you really pushing that to get people to broaden their experiences within the app or try new types of magazine? What's the ultimate aim of that?
It's a combination of both, really. I mean, you know, the bottom line is, of course, readers are going to go to their favourite titles, and we make that easy for them because if you like Vogue, for instance, as soon as you go in, you have the option of favouriting that. And then once the next edition is live, we'll let you know that that's live on the platform. However, if Vogue was sat next to, say, something like Newsweek and you're just about to tap and stream into that magazine and you see a cover line that really appeals to you, there's nothing to stop you from going into Newsweek and start reading that. that article. So really it is about stimulating consumption. And we find, you know, like I said earlier, on the data side, we know, for instance, that Hello readers automatically, the first title that they go into will be Weight Watchers, but then Cosmo readers are also reading Swedish gossip magazines because we're a global platform. So it's bizarre.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so we find that the Swedish customer base love reading British magazines. So, and again, we will push that data over to our publishers.
So I was told a couple of years ago by somebody who'd been in the publishing game for a while that there was a particular magazine who, if they wanted to increase their sales kind of on a week-by-week basis, all they needed to do was put a wet dog on the cover. They were a country lifestyle magazine. And internally, they called it, you know, the kind of the wet dog phenomenon because it would boost their sales.
Yeah.
So what advice then would you have to publishers to make themselves more attractive to the Readly audience within the app? Because there's presumably not a similar wet dog phenomena when it's not in print.
No, the reason why I'm laughing is because when we first launched Readly in the UK, I had a meeting with the publishing director of Psychology's magazine, and I'm sure she won't mind me sharing this with you. And there was a huge debate about covers and what covers sell. Is it, you know, A-list celebrities, female A-list celebrities, or male A-list celebrities? And obviously we can track all of that because we track all the cover lines. We can see, you know, what percentage of your readership are reading, you know, the main cover line as opposed to the teeny weeny little one in the bottom right hand corner. So we offered to do a cover analysis for them, and I remember at the time I think we must have had about 12 issues of Psychology's, and two of them had male A-listers on them. One was Brad Pitt and the other was Robert Downey Jr., and then the remainder of them were all, you know, A-listers from Hollywood, female.
Yeah.
And when we did the research for them and we had a look at the data, you know, the publisher was right. It was an argument between the publisher and the editor. The publisher was right. It is female A-listers that pull in the punters, that actually pull them in and keep them engaged in the within the magazine. However, the top red magazine, this was back in 2014, the top red title for Psychology's was the Robert Downey Jr. cover, which was the sex special. So, you know, cover lines, celebrities on covers, whether it's a wet dog or Robert Downey Jr., covers do matter. It's super, super important in terms of pulling in people, pulling in the customers, making it more attractive for people to read. And then obviously what creates that stickiness is the content, are the articles that are in the magazine. I used to work on the B2B sector, and I remember there was a very, very niche B2B title. I think it was something to do with buses. And the audience used to get really, really annoyed if you would put a woman in front of the bus because...
Oh, God.
See what I mean? That's real nerd alert. I think we all know this. I'm from a publishing background. Covers really do matter. It's important that that what we have on the platform is really enticing. If you look at Readly exclusives, where publishers create content to go onto the Readly platform first, and then following on from that, they might decide to put it out in print or put it on all the other various different platforms. You know, we again share that data with them, and from there they'll be able to see, you know.
And so you just mentioning Readly exclusives. How many publishers are actually trying that out? So what proportion of them do you think are experimenting with that?
We have about 40 titles globally at the moment. We've got a few in the UK. I think we've got about 8 or 9 in the UK. And it all sort of kicked off from Germany initially with Axel Springer. And it started off as being a little bit experimental. They wanted to see whether producing something that was purely for the Readly platform would generate revenue and generate data insight, as we've said, and obviously that worked for them. And then we went back out to the publishers in the UK and then obviously to Sweden. What we try to do when we speak to these publishers is say to them, you know, please don't please don't rehash your content, don't regurgitate the content. It's got to be new. It's got to be exciting and enticing for our customers to go in and read on subject matters that they love. So if you look at the Readly exclusive titles, they are very, very niche, you know, and they're, some of them are a little bit bookazine led. We're still looking at the numbers on that, but you know, more and more publishers are doing it, so it's an exciting project for them and definitely for us too.
Yeah, absolutely. You brought up another point there, which I think is, what is the proportion of publishers you consider to be, I suppose, kind of the big mainstream titles that are on Readly, as opposed to the niche ones? Because surely the kind of the smaller titles don't necessarily have the resources to create bespoke content on there.
You'll be surprised, because you know, some of the ones that we have, I mean, if we're comparing Axel Springer with, say, Black Dog Media in the UK, you know, they're not in the, you know, in terms of revenue and all the rest of it, they're in a totally different league. But we have a mixture. So some of the larger ones will try it out, and then obviously some of the niche ones, if they see that, you know, the big guns are giving it a shot, then they will then they'll come and speak to us about it. But you know, we don't, as long as the content's good and it gets approved, We know that it will be engaging for our customers. We're prepared to give it a shot. We're relatively experimental with stuff like that.
You mentioned Germany then, and before you spoke about the fact that you actually have some news products that are on there now.
Yeah.
Which preempts a question that we were going to ask, which is, to what extent do you feel that news and entertainment, so magazine content, can fit on the same app like this, can fit on the same platform? Because the economics of both, of producing both, are so very different.
Yeah, they are, and I think it boils down to their own individual business models on the publishing side. There's a definite, you know, distinction from the business side, but I think from consumers, definitely not. You know, the lines, I think, this is my personal opinion, are blurred. And what we need to do is to make reading, whether it's magazine reading or newspaper reading, easy for our consumers. And that's one of the things that we're working hard to do. So, you know, we've obviously put the dailies on there. It's just a separate tab on, you know, within the app, so you can just go and click on there. There's no separate price point or anything like that. It's exactly the same format. So it works. It's down to the consumer as to whether they want to read, you know, a couple of magazines that day and then dip into, I don't know, Bild or to Expressen or whichever, you know, whatever takes their fancy. Our job is to make it, you know, to provide content on the go and to make it easy for them. And that's what we're aiming to do.
And, you know, when publishers, particularly news publishers, talk about, you know, wanting to be in control of context now, obviously they've been burned by distributed publishing across platforms like Facebook. Mm-hmm. Do you understand why they are maybe reticent to hand over content and potentially risk that loss of control for how it appears?
Yeah, I think, you know, we had a lot of that when we first launched the business over here. There was a lot of talk about, you know, being disruptive and cannibalization, and you're going to destroy the industry. But I think now the client base, as in the publisher base, are very confident in our ability, and they understand the numbers. They totally get the fact that we're reaching out to a new audience. And the bottom line is that we're not content curators. We our business is, in essence, the publishers. Without them, we wouldn't have any content to put on our platform. So we're there to bring new audiences, bring new eyeballs to their brands.
That's interesting that you say that, kind of, because your product is the publishers, effectively.
Yeah.
That sets you aside from, you know, Facebook and Google and even kind of Apple, which we'll get into in a second, which almost has them as an incidental, you know, side thought or afterthought.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've said this from the get-go, I said to you, like, literally at the start of this chat, that I am from the publishing side. Not everybody has the presence or the ability to produce apps like we do, or to produce the distribution platform to put their content out there. So we, as far as Readly are concerned, we are really assisting them and working in parallel with them and complementing, you know, what they're doing already. We're not taking over in any which way or form. We're working, as I say, even with our marketing, in parallel with what they're doing.
And as a bit of a counterpoint, that last week when this episode goes out, we saw the launch of Apple News Plus.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a news publisher perspective, that was almost universally panned. You know, I don't think I saw a single positive response to what they're doing for news, at least.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's been so, people are more reticent about getting involved with it?
I think it's a number of things. Chris, I'm a massive fan of Apple. We use Macs and iPads and whatnot to demonstrate Readly on their products. So, and it looks really slick and it looks amazing. I think from a publisher perspective, it's already, I think it's already a very fast-moving and disruptive marketplace. And, for now, it means more decisions to make, more choice, more confusion. And they're having to do all of this while they're thinking about audience reach, direct-to-consumer relationships, reading data usage. There's so many things that they have to think about, their brand's profiles. So I think they are worried because Apple can be perceived to be the frenemy as well, just like the other three. So I think there's a lot of concern out there because of that. But it's good for us. I think this just been so much press with reference to Apple News, and I think from a Readly perspective, it's actually really good for us. The publishers will need to make their own decisions as to which way they want to go, just like they had to do with Readly.
Mm. You don't necessarily see this as being a additive thing. This is potentially an either-or thing for a lot of publishers.
Yeah, I think that's really down to them and what sort of strategy they have in mind. We've kind of been at the forefront of that. We've had a lot of publishers saying, we kind of focus on our own digital strategy. We don't want to go to third-party distribution platforms. And I think Apple will have the same sort of curveballs thrown at them. So, That's their battle to fight, I think. I'm glad I'm not doing it now.
We ask all our interviewees, what was the last piece of media you read, watched, consumed in any form that really created an emotional response and that you'd really like to recommend to our listeners?
Oh, gosh. This is a really difficult question because I'm kind of a big fan of podcasts. I love reading as well, but if it was the last thing, I watched Afterlife on Netflix. I don't know whether have you heard of that?
Time I go on Netflix, it's playing the auto ad. Yeah,
yeah, that really made me quite sad, actually. But yeah, I mean, it's nothing to do with media at the end of the day. But it's Netflix, and it's time to relax and sort of get away from your iPhone or your Mac or whatever. And it's quite nice to just kind of totally get absorbed into a TV program, and that was the thing. And I like Radio 4 Book Club. I listen to The Guilty Feminist, and I know you're going to hate me for saying this, Chris, but I really like listening to Media Masters.
Oh, how dare you! How dare you! So for all our UK listeners, we will see you at our London live recording for our 100th episode. I don't know quite how that happened. It only feels like yesterday that me and you, Esther, were sat recording the first one.
In the media briefing rooms, it sounded like we're in a toilet.
It was so echoey. But we're ever so slightly better now, so do keep an eye out on the newsletter this week for details of how to register for that very special event.
Talking of the newsletter, again, deja vu, I feel like we mention this every week, but we have a newsletter. It's got all the links to literally everything we've discussed. It's got links to the transcript and also what we're writing. So you can go sign up for that at our website at voices.media.
And as always, we're on Twitter, Media Voices Pod. That was very short and sweet.
Sweet.
That was like an old-fashioned tweet. That was really 120 characters, right?
140
there.
Characters.
Oh, fuck, I can't.
You don't know your history.
I don't even know what day it is.
So next week is going to be our final episode before our hiatus for Easter, which we're all very much looking forward to. I cannot wait for some more lie-ins. But next week, we will see you back here, same times, for another fantastic guest and another fantastic show. So until then, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Stop Brexit!
You've been planning that the whole episode.